We have two excellent presentations for you today, and we'll get right to them. We want to keep as close to time, respect your time as closely as we can. Our first speaker today, I'm not going to tell you his name till the end, so don't cheat and read, was trained as a geophysicist and a petrochemist. Started his career at Michigan State and then Denison University. Then he spent the next four decades in consulting, engineering, and environmental affairs. And prior to retiring a few years ago, he returned to teaching. He's currently a lecturer in the engineering management program at the University of Kansas. So why are you here? You're in the right conference, right? Also, he has an extensive record collection, which reflects his attempt to balance his love for jazz and opera with his passion for 78s generally. He started to disperse some of his collection, primarily material related to Louis Katzman's career, which seems to be growing quickly nevertheless. He is the grandson of Louis Katzman, Michael Katzman.
Thank you, Tim. As I go through my talk, I will bring back my outline, and in yellow, that section of the talk that I'm going to be on. One of the issues as Louis Katzman's grandson that I've seen is that there are a lot of web pages and books that all refer to him as forgotten or little recalled, and I'm here today to belie that fact. None of his contemporaries are still alive today. But when you get on the internet, as I did, I found 20,000 hits for Louis Katzman in music and more than 6,000 listings for Louis Katzman's records on music sites. And I don't think that's forgotten or little recalled. As his grandson, again, I'm pleased to be here to present information about his background, and then to get into something on his impact on jazz, which is what this session was about. Now, the Katzman family were musicians playing in Europe, in the Pale of Russia, which is southwestern Russia and southeastern Europe. Philip's father was a member of the Moscow Opera Company in Moscow. And Louis was trained as a classical musician in conservatories in both Odessa and in Kishinev, where the family lived. Neither of those cities are in Russia anymore. And then at the age of 13, Louis recalled in his memoirs that he was sent out to work with a traveling bandmaster in arriving in New York in 1907 as a teenager. Steady work was very difficult to find, obviously for somebody who was a classical musician as well as that young. And he played in bands at night while he had a full-time day job, and then also performed in a klezmer band that was fronted by his uncle, Abraham Katzman. In 1908, and between 1908 and 1910, he did find full-time work as a musician on the Hudson River day lines and in their orchestras. Now, the day lines ran excursion boats between Manhattan and Albany, and they all had orchestras with anywhere from 6 to 16 people, and they played the songs of the day as well as some light semi-classical music. In 1910, Katzman worked with Maurice Levy at the Churchill's Restaurant in New York, and he played the cornet, and he also prepared orchestrations for the band. At the same time, he arranged music for Harry Yerkes and his various marimba bands, and in this case, this was the marimba phone band. In those days, part of the issue in making records was that everything was through horns rather than through microphones as we're used to today. So it took special arrangements at that time. In 1913, Katzman went to work as a trumpet player in the newly opened Palace Theater, which was primarily vaudeville. One of his prideful moments was that Sarah Bernhard was presenting in the first year that Palace Theater was open, was presenting her act, and Louis Katzman orchestrated the music that went along with Sarah Bernhard's act. He left the Palace in 1916 and went over to the Riverside Theater, which was also a vaudeville house, and where he was an orchestrator. He started out as a session player and then eventually wound up as the leader of the orchestra at Riverside. And all of this, his reputation as an orchestrator and arranger was growing, so that many of the vaudeville acts asked him to prepare and arrange the material for their acts, which led to the next phase of his life, which was as an orchestrator and as an arranger. And this is what he did most of his remaining days. Now, in 1916, Katzman joined Edison Records, and then a few years later became a orchestrator for the Edison Company, and he worked with such firms as the Jazz O'Harmonist, the Merry Sparklers, Atlantic Dance Orchestra, the Jazzarimba Orchestra, and a number of those types of bands. While he was at Edison, he was hired by the Whitmark Publishing Company as their staff arranger. And in his 1941 book, Whitmark, the book was called Ragtime to Swing, Whitmark stated, and I'll quote here, that they looked around for the best that was available and decided on Louis Katzman, excuse me, and that of course makes me feel very good. Katzman arranged most of the instrumental hits, if you will, the successes for Whitmark from 1921 to 1923, and these included jazz standards such as Love Will Find a Way by Cecil and Blake, as well as Fate, and of course California Here I Come by Jolson. You can just barely make out, arranged by Louis Katzman up there in the corner. In succeeding years, after he left Whitmark, he was an independent arranger and worked for a variety of number of companies. He was also a composer in his own right, and he had a 1919 hit, which was called Bevo Blues. And the same year, not getting too far from his classical background, he also authored a book called 10 Concert Duets for Advanced Players. And he was a cornet player, and this was primarily classical music. In 1932, he co-authored the Songs of Gold Miners, and this was a very popular, and despite the Depression, when nobody had very much money, it was a very highly profitable music booklet that was published. In 1940, he joined Broadcast Music, Inc., where he produced numerous classical public domain arrangements for radio broadcasts and transcriptions. BMI at that time was its own publishing company, and typical Katzman arrangements included the Barcarolle by Offenbach, Donne Mobile, and Celeste Aida by Verdi, and of course the Prelude in G by Rachmaninoff. His renown as an arranger also gave him entree to Broadway, and he was one of the arrangers, for example, for the Ziegfeld Follies in between 1923 and 1927, and he orchestrated three shows for George White, Scandals, as well as the Music Box Review for Irving Berlin. None of us here, I assume, are old enough to remember any of those. He also orchestrated a number of successful, and on Broadway not so successful, musicals, including Nikki, Mercenary Mary, and the revival of the Marx Brothers Coconuts in 1927. And then the last stage productions he was involved in before he passed away was musical direction for a Broadway revival, and then also for the 1943 orchestration for Bill Bojangles Robinson's production of Born Happy. Katzman was also a recording star, and starting in 1916, as I mentioned before, he recorded several solo cornet pieces of classical music for Edison. Found this ad, and you can see I didn't know if I was going to have a pointer today, so I put the arrow in. Whoops. I put the arrow there, and this is an ad in the El Paso newspaper for his one of his 1916 recordings for Edison. He became a session player and a band leader for various Edison units, such as the Jazz O'Harmonist, Broadway Dance, and the Atlantic Dance Orchestra. This is one of his orchestras that he was involved with, the Jazz O'Harmonist for Edison. All told, he played in or directed more than 80 diamond discs or cylinders for Edison. And these included 44 Atlantic Dance Orchestras, 16 of the Jazz O'Harmonists, and at least 20 others as a soloist or as an orchestrator. After leaving Edison and almost simultaneously with starting his radio career in 1922, one of the very earliest in radio, he signed with the Aeolian Vocaline Company. Of course, as many of you know, in 1924, Vocaline was purchased by Brunswick, and Katzman continued to work for Brunswick right through the early 1930s. And early Brunswick and Vocaline records were all acoustical, but in 1925, electric recordings were introduced primarily by Victor and Columbia, and they used a Western Electric process. Brunswick, on the other hand, licensed a photoelectric cell system, as illustrated here, from General Electric. This is a Christian Science Monitor article from 1926. That's Louis Katzman, and that's the microphone that was being used by Brunswick at that time. Now, of course, the quality control on this was not very good, so shortly after this, Brunswick switched back to normal microphones for enhanced quality control. I have more than 130 Katzman sides on Vocaline and more than 120 Brunswick records in my collection, and these are probably half of the total since of these two labels. An ironic thing is, in those days, a lot of companies would issue labels on using aliases or pseudonyms, and issue labels on other records on other labels as well. So Laird, in his Brunswick discography, indicates that, for example, in one case, Brunswick published put out a record by the Ambassadors, which also, under other aliases, appeared on Arco, Beltona, Coliseum, and Duophone labels. Same record, just put out under different names. Katzman used more than 60 pseudonyms for his orchestras during his career, one of which was the Louis Katzman and His Kittens, and this is British pressing. Part of the issue here was infringement, and he couldn't use the name of his band, the Anglo-Persians, in Great Britain. Other aliases that were used were strictly for commercial purposes, so that Katzman recorded under the name of the Castilians, Los Floridians, Marimba Salvadoreña, and this was primarily to attract Latin American audiences. He even used a pseudonym himself as Luis Medrano, as a personal recording alias for South American sales. One Katzman orchestra for which I can find no records is what is called the LK Symphony Ensemble. And LK was also the name of a Katzman-owned publishing company. So if anybody out there has one of those, I'd be interested in hearing from you after my talk. I do have one unusual record in my collection, and this is a recording that was produced by Radiotone Records sometime in the 1930s. And this actually is in very bad shape, but what it is it's a piece of cardboard with the pictures, and that's Louis Katzman, and the information, and then it has a plastic sheath, plastic-like material. I mean, there was not plastic in those days, which carried all the grooves for the record. In 1927, Katzman was appointed the musical director of Brunswick Laboratories, and in 1929, he was named as the general manager of Brunswick's New York recording labs. When Brunswick was eventually purchased by ARC, the American Record Company, Katzman then signed with Decca. 1934. He produced about 30 records, 30 sides for Decca until mid-1935, when he was hired by Wynn's radio station in New York. One other issue about, part of the Katzman background is the fact that he did a lot of work for transcription companies, such as Langworth and Muzak. Now, we dismiss Muzak today as elevator music, but back in the 30s, Muzak produced a lot of jazz, popular, and classical artists for transcriptions for play by radio stations. And he, Katzman, recorded with many of the stars on Muzak, and these were, and this is an ad that Muzak put out in the late 30s, and a nice, pretty picture of Katzman as well. But Katzman played with Jan Peerce, Lou Radaman, Irene Beasley, and other stars of that day. After joining BMI, Katzman continued to do transcriptions, and this is a transcription that he put together. When the U.S. joined in World War II, and before the appearance of what we call V-discs, or the Army and Navy transcriptions, Katzman, I'm getting used to the technology here shortly, I'm sorry, but he produced this material for broadcast music, primarily, as you can see, patriotic songs and that type of thing. Katzman also was a radio star for many years, and in the early 1920s, radio found him, I don't know how to put that, but he was one of the very first band leaders to have a theme song. And this is such as this music for the Whitehall Anglo-Persian Rug Hour, which was on the air from 1924 through 1930 for a total of 6 years. Sponsors liked theme songs because after a while the theme song became connected to the sponsor, and of course this brought people's mind to the sponsor's product as well. From the 1920s through the mid-1930s, he directed a variety of orchestras on the radio for a number of sponsors such as Hoover, Michelin, Quaker State, Fuller Brush, and of course the Fred Allen program. And this is actually a local radio station, KMBC, one of the oldest in the Midwest, and there's Louis Katzman's orchestra. This was an advertising material that would, and you can't see it, but there were some hooks on the back here with wire, and this would hang in the window of a variety of record stores and other things in the local area. Now, perhaps Katzman's most memorable radio program was George Gershwin's Music in America. In 1934, he was chosen as the leader for this and musical director for Gershwin's first syndicated radio program, and he formed a very close friendship with Gershwin, a working relationship as well. Now, Jablonski, in his 1987 biography, noted that Gershwin would bring in rough drafts of parts of the Porgy and Bess score as he was working on it, and he would use Katzman's orchestra as a test, the radio orchestra, in rehearsal as a test run. And this is an actual George Gershwin music from A Crap Game. This has been authenticated as in George Gershwin's handwriting. And this was part of Katzman's legacy, and he left it to his son, who in turn left it to me when he passed away. In 1935, Katzman was appointed as the musical director for WINS in New York. And in those days, stations had their own in-house orchestra for live programming. This was a Hearst network in New York. And it also utilized disc jockeys, one of the first stations to utilize disc jockeys for both classical as well as for popular music. Now, the Wynn's connection is very important because this gave Katzman entree into the National Association of Broadcasters, which were primary in the birth of broadcast music. Now, although he typically is unheralded in the history books, he was a significant player in the National Association of Broadcasters confrontation with ASCAP. And what happened was that the ASCAP was going to raise the rates substantially, so the broadcasters got together and decided that they would try and have an alternative to ASCAP. Katzman presented what he called the LK plan, somewhere in here. There, the LK plan, which is really, if you look, Lewis Katzman LK, and that's what it was named for. And this proposal was to set up an alternative to ASCAP. And this was finally funded in 1939. Katzman presented this plan 3 years in a row, 36, 37, 38, until it was accepted by the NAB in 1939. And as I said, the impetus for that was that the contract with ASCAP was going to run out in December of 1940, and they decided that they had to do something. NAB set aside $1.5 million, not a lot of money today, but in 1939, that was a lot of money, and tasked a man named Sidney Kay with implementing the LK plan. And Sidney Kay also became the very first president of broadcast music. Now, this did not end Katzman's association with BMI, however. Once the boycott commenced, only public domain music or music by non-ASCAP writers could be played by participating stations. So BMI set up its own arranging department, and this is a photograph of the arranging department back in 1940, to put out arrangements so that radio stations would have something to play, because the only other choice was not to play music at all. So they could not play ASCAP music. And Katzman was part of the, was originally appointed as a co-director of the BMI Transcription Services. One of the other things Katzman did while he was BMI was Katzman worked in vaudeville and in the 1925 period. And one of the things in vaudeville, because orchestras were always changing inside, they had something that they called cross-cueing, so that if you had music that was normally written for saxophones and you didn't have any saxophones in your orchestra, you could find other instruments to take their place. So, and after the death of vaudeville and after talkies came in they were no longer movie theater orchestras, this concept of cross-cueing kind of died out. Well, Katzman resurrected it for broadcast music, and a lot of the music that was done for BMI also had this cross-cueing. One other thing for BMI that Katzman did was that when BMI was putting out their transcriptions, they had about 40 to 50 pianists who would try out the music. Well, Katzman recommended that BMI get themselves an orchestra, because you can't tell what a radio program will be like just from a pianist. So they, in essence, to test drive the orchestrations. BMI agreed to this, Katzman and then headed up the orchestra at BMI. And then the other thing, as I mentioned earlier, Katzman also was an arranger for BMI and has put out a large number of, and these are primarily classical music as indicated here. And Katzman was a key player with BMI until his death in 1943. Okay, now we're getting down to what everybody in this room is interested in, and this is jazz and Katzman's relationship to jazz. Katzman was an immigrant and he was a classical musician, and jazz probably did not come naturally to him. But I think living in New York in the period of the 19-teens, when ragtime, stride, blues, Dixieland, and even Chicago jazz was making its way into the New York scene, this had to be very exciting for a young 20-something musician at that time. His first apparent link that I can trace was in the late 19-teens, when he was an orchestrator for many of the Edison house bands, including the Jazzarimba band, as shown here. He also orchestrated, as I mentioned earlier, for the Broadway dance band, Merry Sparklers, etc. And a lot of these bands put out jazz sides. Now, Katzman was engaged also as a session player and then a leader or orchestrator for other jazz-style groups, or other groups that maybe occasionally would put out a jazz side. And these included such as the Jazz O'Harmonists, the Atlantic Dance Orchestra, Cotton Pickers, Colonial Club, and the Georgians. Now, more rarely, he also played with or led sessions with true jazz bands, such as the Wolverines, shown here, and Tennessee Tudors, Charleston Seven, the original Memphis Five, the Hottentots, etc. And all of these were early jazz bands that were recording at that time, many for Edison. Katzman also produced in 1929 a long-playing record, one of the very first long-playing records of the St. Louis Blues and Beale Street Blues. And the band was, I believe, the Ambassadors, and this was his way of adopting jazz to non-jazz orchestras. As the 20s progressed, especially in the Depression years, Katzman's recording were a mix of both jazz as well as semi-classical and popular music. Now, and I'll quote here in a book from the Voices of the Jazz Age, published in 1990. Defa was the writer, and his statement, and I quote, "Many of the greatest jazz bands of the 1920s were made, jazz records of the 1920s were made by musicians who are earning their living playing commercial music, whether in pit bands, dance halls, or on the radio, you know, as in here, and they were not producing jazz." Katzman took evident pride in having worked with or mentored a number of outstanding jazz players. And among these, and I won't bore you with a long list, were the Dorsey Brothers, okay, Miff Mole, Red Nichols, Phil Napoleon, Bernie Kruger, Harry Reaser, Andy Sinella, and Chick Bullock all worked with Katzman at one time or another. Katzman also had other session players, and I do apologize for this, but this is not the original was not very good at all. Other jazz performers in their own right, albeit not as famous as the ones that I just mentioned, and some appear in here, such players as Earl Oliver, which some of you may know, Izzy Farmerman, Herman Farberman, Joe Tarto, and the jazz accordionist Cornell Smeltzer. All of these worked with Katzman. Most of these names now are not famous, and they're probably appreciated or remembered only by the most dedicated jazz buffs. These many famous and less known jazz musicians with whom he played or directed or mentored, I take as Katzman's most important contribution to jazz. However, he also did orchestrating and arranging for many jazz orchestras and tunes, and some of these were jazz tunes at the time or became jazz standards at a later date, okay, such as the production here, The Fate. Now, his stock arrangements were taken a typical fare for many jazz recordings, and bands in those days stuck very closely to the written score. Remember, you only had 3 minutes recording, so there was not a lot of room for improvisation at that time, and whatever limited jazz riffs or syncopation might or might not be present were actually scored into the music. Now, Sudhalter, in his 1999 book called Lost Chords, makes this quite clear, and he was talking about the Memphis Five, with whom, by the way, Katzman played and directed. And I'll quote here, "The Memphis Fives appear to have routined their arrangements in advance and in detail, even down to the supposedly extempore hot solos. A routine on one number is not only doesn't change from take to take, but remains similar from session to session." And he finishes by saying this was a more widespread practice than has been generally acknowledged. An example of this was Choo Choo, I Gotta Hurry Home. And Mark Tucker, in his book on Ellington, describes how Katzman's arrangement was the standard for popular jazz orchestras of that time. And this included the Ambassadors, which was Katzman's own group, the original Memphis Five, Adriani, Rollini, et cetera. But Katzman's score also was the basis for Ellington's recording when Ellington recorded the song with his band, the Washingtonians. Perhaps Katzman's most famous notable jazz arrangements was the Meanest Kind of Blues, which was done for the Fletcher Henderson Orchestra as well as for Louis Armstrong. This piece was so closely identified with Katzman that he was erroneously listed as the composer. He did not compose this music. It was done by B. Lou Jackson. Katzman also arranged other blues and jazz pieces, including Razor's Edge, Bass Isle Blues, etc., which were recorded by Phil Napoleon, Mean Dog Blues, which was recorded by Red Nichols, Five Pennies, etc. Some of these and other jazz compositions were actually published by Katzman's own publishing company, Audubon Publishing in this case, and he had another one as well. Which was called the LK for his initials, publishing company. Katzman also arranged some of the earlier Fletcher Henderson compositions, and this is notably, this is the Minas Blues, and this is not related to Minas Kind of Blues, which I just mentioned a moment ago. This was recorded by the original Memphis Five in 1924. Now, Howland, in his 1920 book on Ellington, indicates that this arrangement for this music was played by Vincent Lopez at the Metropolitan House, Opera House, and I quote, in one of the most prominent efforts to combine symphonic jazz with Harlem blues and jazz. And the program involved African-American contributions such as Fletcher Henderson's The Minas Blues here, in an orchestral development by Lopez and the arranger Louis Katzman, end quote. Katzman also developed what he called symphono jazz, which was a marriage of jazz and symphonic music, and he developed, orchestrated, and presented this in a number of concerts on the radio, etc. This was also W.C. Handy's music was also presented in symphonic form, and Howland, in an article titled Jazz Rhapsodies in Black and White, indicated that Handy took great pride in symphonic jazz borrowings by white orchestra leaders. And then I went back to the original, and in discussing his St. Louis blues and its use by a number of orchestras, Handy stated in his 1941 autobiography, and I'll quote again, the recording companies noting this trend to the symphonic and blues made them available on wax. Voorhees was one of the first to record such blues symphonically. Then Louis Katzman on Brunswick, whose record was used in the first American Negro ballet produced by Van Grona, end quote. The mix of classical music and jazz was called the Third Stream by Schuller, and it's never really disappeared. I mean, Glenn Miller, Woody Herman, Ellington incorporated some classical borrowings at times, and of course later on, Dave Brubeck, George Shearing. You know what, even Miles Davis and some of the work that was produced by Gil Evans borrowed from symphonic and classical music. And the point I'm trying to make here is that Katzman's synthesis of classical and jazz music was not so unusual. Paul DeBarros points out, he wrote a recent biography of Marion McPartland, and if you haven't read it, I suggest that you try and get your hands on it. And he stated that the harsh criticism of jazz-classical marriage could be attributed to snobbish prejudice against jazz players involved in the classical arena. Of course, in the 1920s and 1930s, the white establishment didn't complain or displayed snobbish prejudice when musicians such as Paul Whiteman and Harry Reeser, Gene Coltrane, Ben Burney, and yes, Katzman, invaded, exploited, and appropriated the jazz genre for themselves. Now, the bands I just mentioned, for most people who understand jazz, are probably more important for the people who played in them than for the actual music that those ensembles played themselves. Now, I've said nothing about, and I'm about to wrap up here, and this slide is out of the way, but this is the symphono jazz series that Katzman orchestrated and developed. I've said nothing about Katzman's personal and family life. I mean, he did have a personal and family life, and so let me leave you with this last photo, which appeared in Broadcasting Magazine in December of 1940. And in conclusions, Katzman led a who's who of musicians in his orchestras, in concerts, on Broadway, on the radio, and in the recording studio. But it was the contemporary unknown musicians that he supported and mentored whether they later became stars or just remained session players, that gave Katzman the most pleasure and pride, and which he felt was his lasting contribution to American music. Katzman's life revolved around music. To paraphrase a message he once delivered, quote, "God's greatest gift to mankind is music," unquote. For Katzman, music with a capital M was indeed a way of life. And I thank you for your attention. Oh, any questions? If you want to email me, please.
We'll have to hold questions till the end of the session. If there's time, we'll be happy to take them then.